You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. To the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Jen Zaman and I am in for Judy Ansel, who is away. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Pipefitters Local 533 and Boyd, Kenter, and Thomas and Parrish LLC and the Missouri AFL-CIO. The Pipefitter powers the engines of industry that keep businesses thriving in America. They install, maintain, and service any system that involves air conditioning, heating, chemicals, or refrigeration in residential, commercial, or industrial buildings, as well as high-tech clean rooms. Since 1983, Boyd, Kenter, Thomas, and Parrish Law Firm has emphasized its efforts in all types of labor law, union-related claims, and employment law disputes. The attorneys at BKTP have the experience and expertise to represent those who have been injured or killed in the workplace for hundreds of clients in both Missouri and Kansas. Visit our website at BKTP.law to contact us for a free consultation. And the Missouri AFL-CIO is building unions across Missouri. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, Kansas has got a new Secretary of Labor. Her name is Delia Garcia, and she's the first Latina to serve in a cabinet post. We'll get to know her on tonight's show. Then, the City of Kansas City, Missouri is about to embark on a study to assess gender pay equity in city jobs. The results should provide a map for attacking the pay gap. In the news, two really bad decisions from the NLRB, and the AFL-CIO says the new NAFTA needs fixing. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. And now for the news.
News from our side, May 16, 2019. AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka sent a letter to members of Congress urging them to oppose efforts by the Trump administration and its corporate backers to push through passage of NAFTA 2.0, now called USMCA, United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, until its labor standards and their enforcement are significantly improved and its language, locking in high medicine prices, is eliminated. Trumka said the new agreement makes some progress, but does not meaningfully address what's wrong with NAFTA, because Mexico has not yet implemented real labor law reform or shown it will eliminate hundreds of thousands of protected contracts that now stand in for real union contracts. These contracts are between so-called ghost or white unions, essentially company unions in management. Workers in those companies often have no idea what they have in a union contract and no real protection. Trumka said that USMCA provides a veneer of protections for working families and political cover to advance this deal while keeping in place a system of worker oppression as the prevailing North American economic model. it will not stop the current hemorrhaging of jobs to Mexico. Trump also complained about the lack of country of origin labeling on food and limiting our ability to lower the cost of prescription drugs. The agreement would lock in existing U.S. policies that have kept the price of medicine sky high. The Citizens Trade Campaign is asking people to send an automated email to their congressional representative. You can do so by going to the AFL-CIO.org/issues/trade on the web.
The Heart and Labor Forum staff is saddened by the death of Equity actor Kip Niven. Kip and Sarah Labar were on the show we did about the Actors Equity Union here in Kansas City. Because of that, Kip volunteered occasionally to read news on this show. We volunteers knew we were in the company of a real pro the moment he opened his mouth. Kip was a firm believer in unions, and when Equity joined the Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO, Kip was one of the delegates. Several years ago, Kip was one of the founders of Equity Actors Reader Theater, otherwise known as EARTH. For Labor Day last year, they did readings from Stud Terkel's classic Working. It was Kip who told us about the play about the Triangle Shirtwaist Company fire at the theater on the Longview campus, and a bunch of us went to see it. And Kip had a real sense of what was a good play, and somehow EARTH put on some very socially conscious works. Kip had a major role in Kevin Willmott's movie Jayhawkers, and was in Magnum Force and on the TV show Alice. A fellow actor, Doug Weaver, said that Kip was like the glue that held the theater world together.
Trump's National Labor Relations Board has been up to no good for unions this last week. First, they postponed the Volkswagen election, and then they ruled that Uber drivers weren't employees, just contractors. In the case of Volkswagen, the United Auto Workers had filed for their second election to represent workers in the Chattanooga, Tennessee. You might remember the first campaign was fraught with threats and political interference by Tennessee's Republican officials, and the UAW narrowly lost. After that, the union won an election with a small unit of 160 skilled trade workers at the plant, but they never got a contract. The company used the charges the union filed over that to try to block the current attempt to get an election that would cover all 1,700 VW workers, but Trump's NLRB last week on a strict party line vote that they would postpone the election indefinitely. By the way, Volkswagen still claims it's being neutral, a claim the union seriously rejects. According to PAI News, the local is heavily African American, as is the Chattanooga's plant workforce. So its number, Local 42, honors the late Jackie Robinson, who broke baseball's color barrier. 42 was Robinson's uniform number with the Brooklyn Dodgers.
The second NLRB decision involved Uber. This was a decision of the NLRB's Associate General Counsel, Jamie Sofer. This division now gets all major, potentially major cases before the board does, and acts as a gatekeeper, deciding which ones get memos back downwards to regional offices and which ones head upwards for NLRB rulings. In this case, Sofer declared that tens of thousands of Uber drivers nationwide who just engaged in their own strike by turning off their apps and refusing to pick up riders, she declared them independent contractors. This decision not only deprives the Uber drivers of the right to organize, but also making the drivers contractors saves Uber millions of dollars in payroll taxes, jobless benefits, and workers' compensation insurance premiums. And it forces the drivers to pay for the taxes along with their cars, tires, gas, insurance, and repairs. Sofer used a January 2019 ruling by the Trump-named GOP NLRB board majority as a precedent. in a case involving super shuttle drivers at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. The key issue in determining whether Uber drivers are employees who have the right to organize in unions or otherwise, or independent contractors, is if the company's control of their work is greater than the driver's own entrepreneurial opportunities. Sophia wrote, "How much of each fare the company keeps also factors into the decision," he said. "That's on top of other factors the NLRB used to determine whether any worker is an independent contractor." The Dallas-Fort Worth Airport super shuttle drivers had total control over their work schedules, kept all the fares they collected, and had discretion over which trips to perform, he explained, so they're independent contractors. The Uber drivers, Sophia said, have near complete control of their cars and work schedules and could even go to work for Uber's competitors, such as taxis and Lyft, though he didn't name them at the same time. These and other factors strongly support independent contractor status and outweigh all other facts supporting the employee status, Sophia said. The news tonight was read by Michael Savoir, Greg Schwartz, Tom Gebkin, and myself, Chris Mann.
Well, I don't believe it, I'll be breaking even between times payday rolls around. So I have gotta keep on treading water as I drift away from dry ground. I live from paycheck to paycheck is all I could do. It never works out quite right. It'll take luck to be left with a buck to last me until next Friday night. Well, all of the bosses, they gotta cut costs, but we're always the ones that pays. And now I hear that again this year, we gotta give up that 1% raise.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. Delia Garcia will be sworn in on June 5th as Kansas's new Secretary of Labor. She brings some great experience to the job. Her labor credentials come from 8 years in leadership in the national organizations Reflect U.S., National Migrant Seasonal Head Start Association, and with the NEA, that's the National Education Association, in Washington, D.C. She is the first Latina elected to public office in Kansas in 2004. She was elected to the Kansas House of Representatives, where she served for 6 years. And thanks to Governor Laura Kelly, she is now the first Latina Kansas Cabinet Secretary. Welcome to the show, Delia.
Thank you so much, Judy.
Can I call you Delia, or do I?
Absolutely. Okay. No, absolutely. Family.
Okay, great. So let's start by integrating all that experience I just mentioned with your new job.
Yes.
You worked with the public employee union in the legislature with migrant workers. How does all that experience feed into your vision for the people of Kansas?
Well, thank you, Judy, for first allowing me this opportunity to be on your show. You know, and also it's just great to be back home in Kansas, integrating all of my experiences of what you just mentioned. You know, one of the other jobs, the most recent one that I left actually recently as of February, was Reflect Us as well, which is a women's coalition of both progressive and conservative women working together to elect and appoint women across the country. And, you know, that was really what we did with this, in my own position. We were watching Governor Kelly in her election from Washington, D.C., and I was super excited that she was running and also supported her as well. And, you know, putting together the small business aspect and growing up in a small business here in Kansas, which is my family owns the oldest family-owned Mexican restaurant in the state of Kansas, with customer service at a young age, because I was 10 years old when I started working in the restaurant.
Where is that restaurant?
It's in Wichita, in North Wichita.
Cool.
And so all five of us daughters, you know, grew up in the customer service, you know, industry in a small business in Kansas. And so early on, at the age of 10, I that was always instilled in me, the hard work ethic by my grandparents and my mother and father. But the customer service is one, the common thread through all of the jobs I've ever worked. And that's something that I'm going to be working full force here at the Kansas Department of Labor, is, you know, listening to our constituents, listening to internally our, you know, our own agency staff, who are amazing and hardworking. And the moment I walked in here, you know, I have to be honest, there was a little people a little shaky because they thought, oh my gosh, who is this? You know, Secretary Garcia might fire some everybody on the first day, because unfortunately that has happened in the past with another secretary. And that's just not my style. My style is to sit down and talk, listen, and talk to you, but listen first and see how we can work together to deliver the best customer service in Kansas.
Okay, great. Well, I imagine, you know, since you were a child laborer, you'll have an eye out for that in Kansas, right?
Absolutely, yes. You know, working with our migrant families, I served as an executive director of the National Migrant Seasonal Head Start Association. And, you know, a lot of our families were in ag across the country. And we would still see, you know, in places like North Carolina, and I presume it, there's other places, but, you know, they would have, because of they have little hands, you know, they would say, oh, well, they're good for picking the blueberries. And though we don't sell blueberries here in Kansas, and I know that we have certain farm laws, as long as it's family, you know.
Right.
Of course, my own family did that with us. It's a family restaurant. But, of course, we would absolutely be working, making sure that that doesn't happen, because no child should be working under the ages of the laws that we have in Kansas.
Right, and I was joking, of course. I know that, you know, families often work, and children work in family-owned businesses, and that's perfectly
legal.
Well,
it's funny, because I always say, even as a state legislator, as you know, we don't get paid that much in the legislature, and so I would go home on the weekends, and I would serve as a waitress, and I would tell people, you don't say no to your mother who gives you that matriarch look. There's just no way. But as a child and even a state legislator.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, that keeps you in, well, sympathetic with working people, too, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So give us an overview of what the Department of Labor does. What laws do you enforce? What programs do you have? I think probably most people aren't very aware of what you do.
Right. Thank you. So we at the Department of Labor, we, you know, support our Kansas economy by working with both employers and employees, and we have a wide-ranging programs. Our two largest programs that's important for people to know is our unemployment insurance and our workers' comp.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll talk about more of that throughout the rest of it. But we facilitate basically harmonious relations between both unions and public employers. We also assist workers in recovering unpaid wages, and we conduct safety consultations for businesses. A lot of people don't know we do that. We aid workers who have been injured on the job. We also provide guidance to employers on classification of workers, which is a huge issue, and provide objective and accurate labor market information for all Kansans. That's one area. We are the agency, out of all the agencies in Kansas, who host the most amount of statistics, and a lot of people just don't use us. And so one of the things I want to do as a new secretary is make sure we push out all that information, and even in cool and hip, new energetic ways through our social media and then anybody who asks us.
Let me ask you before I forget then, how do you find those statistics?
Oh, you can come to our website at www.dol.ks.gov. Thank you for asking. And then you can click on labor market information, and you can find the different counties. And then also, if you think we should be doing a better job in providing other stuff, you can also contact my office, or also our emails on there as well. And that's www.dol.ks.gov.
Okay, good. So when Governor Kelly appointed you, did she share any of her goals for workers in Kansas or workers and employers with you? And is she urging you to do any particular things?
Well, the Governor Kelly is absolutely urging each of us cabinet secretaries to do an internal audit. You know, a lot of the agencies were having to clean up and rebuild. And so that's where we're at now. I'm happy to share that I have my executive team as of May 1st in place. And so one of the things that she also wanted us to take a look at, this, as she said in the beginning, is really pay respect and have our public employees treated with respect. We have a lot of classified versus unclassified, so we are taking a hard look issue at that. We actually have an upcoming retreat next month to do just that. And I was really excited that the governor came to visit our hardest working employees at our call center here that deal every day, every hour with our unemployed claimants on the phone. And she went to come like in mid-March to just say thank you, and that, you know, we are going to work hard to see how we can clean up and undo sort of what the previous administration did with making everybody, most of my agency is 80-20, 80% unclassified, where they're not protected. And that does not do good for staff morale. So that's, for me, internally, she's making sure that the governor is making sure that we make sure we are listening and talking and working with all of our staff and supporting them in the best ways possible. And we are doing that. We have done that really actively every week.
Okay, so one of the big legal violations in Kansas is the issue of wage theft. In fact, wage theft is rampant among immigrants, but not just immigrants. And, you know, under Governor Sebelius, her Secretary of Labor, Jim Garner, put a lot of emphasis on enforcing and giving workers a way to collect wages that were not paid. So how do you see this issue, and do you have any particular plans yet on how to combat wage theft?
Thank you for acknowledging that, because we do administer the Kansas Wage Payment Act, and we simply want people to know, and that this is part of my plan to moving forward, is, well, one, if you work, you have to be paid, bottom line, period. In terms of my priorities, I want to get the message out that this law exists and that my staff are ready to assist any workers who have been wrongfully denied payment, and that we're here to assist employers in educating them as well about the requirements of this law and their responsibilities in this area. Any impacted worker can get additional information at our website as well, or they can call our Employment Standards Division. I can share that number with you, 785-296-5000. But one of the things Secretary Garner did that I appreciated, when I was a state legislator and he was a Secretary of Labor, he worked with some of us legislators who were willing to partner with him and host clinics, which I know you do as well, and I want to thank you for your hard work.
Well, I volunteer at the Wage Theft Clinic in Kansas City, Kansas.
Yeah, so I want to open that invitation to do that again. And those who are interested, in the beginning, when the legislative session started, I made sure my team hand-delivered individually, directly, to each of the state legislators, all of our contact information, the major things that they could use, and also that I'll be following up with them when I do my CADL site visits across the state after session is over, which is starting next month, to be able to join and partner with some of the legislators who are willing to partner with us to host some of these. We had a huge issue with misclassification of workers in Wichita. And in my district, I would co-host the clinics with the Department of Labor, and I plan on doing that again and going another step further and putting some of that information out using being innovative and using social media. And so we have established a new Instagram account. We had Facebook, we have Twitter, but right now, a lot more people are using Instagram, and so we want to make sure we're going to Kansans and not expecting them to come to us all the time.
Yeah, well, and because our immigrant population, which is significant in Kansas, is often the greatest victims of these violations of the law, I hope you're going to be doing that social media in other languages as well.
Yes, I'm happy to share that. Since I do speak some Spanish, I like to say I speak Selena Spanish, so that's Spanglish. When we started our Instagram account, we did it both in English and Spanish, and I'm proud to say that we're one of the first agencies who are updating all of our materials in English and Spanish, and I want to go in other languages. I think Vietnamese is, and then Somalian in Southwest Kansas.
Uh-huh.
But anybody else who has that, we'll be looking at those other resources to offer that in.
Great. Well, we're talking to Delia Garcia, who is the new Kansas Secretary of Labor. And I'm Judy Ansel. This is the Heartland Labor Forum. You know, Kansas isn't known for its pro-labor environment. Not only is it a right-to-work state, but recently public employees suffered a great deal under the Brownback administration with the attack on teacher tenure and due process. We lost the local option here in Kansas City, Kansas, to have prevailing wage laws, too, during the Brownback administration. Can you play a role in bringing back more respect for the rights of workers?
I absolutely can, and I will. One of the things I'm very proud to share, in my first month, in the first 2 weeks, I met with my executive team, and I had to let go of some of the previous people as well. And I made sure that my team knew that I wanted to make sure that we called a meeting of all the union leaders to let them know, one, that they have an ally here, and that, you know, some of them, many of them, I worked with when I was a state legislator, and shared that they had not stepped foot into the Department of Labor office for the past 8 years. And I didn't like hearing that. And so I'm one person who likes to be a collaborator. I'm a middle child of five daughters. So one of the things I said right away to my team is, let's have that meeting. And in January, we held a meeting with the Kansas the Workers Alliance at one of their meetings in January, mm-hmm. and said, okay, here I am. I'm back. Those of you who don't know me, this is me. This is what I want to do, work together, collaborate together. And also, of course, did that with the business community as well. But I wanted to make sure that we specifically sent the message to our labor sisters and brothers that we are here to work together. You know, our department administers many programs. Some of these programs are related to labor relations. And so our role under the Kansas law is to provide a fair and efficient mechanism for public employers and labor relations to resolve, you know, any grievances and disputes. But generally speaking, across all of our programs, we want to ensure that workers and employers receive the excellent customer service when they seek, you know, our help in programs that we administer. So we want to continue doing that.
Good. Well, you know, you said one of your biggest programs is workers' comp. And, you know, I think that the Kansas workers' comp laws are pretty weak. A friend of mine is right now going through the process where she was injured at work. Her employer denied sending her to the doctor after she complained and complained. Months later, they finally did. When they found out she had a serious injury, they cut her off and wouldn't pay her according to the law. And now she's had to hire a lawyer and is going after them. But, you know, it seems to me that it's pretty easy for these employers to intimidate workers and get away with violating the law.
No, absolutely agree. It makes me disgusted when I hear that employers do that. You know, workers' comp is a very complex law. I'll admit that. But there have been several changes made over the last several years. In particular, right when I left Kansas, was in 2010 and 2011, a lot of not so good laws came into effect. That particularly was regarding the workers' comp. And one change in workers' comp law required the sixth edition of the American Medical Association guidelines and replacing the fourth edition. And I want to share with you all that the Kansas Court of Appeals found this provision to the law to be unconstitutional. And it's no longer, because it no longer provides injured workers an adequate remedy. So the Kansas Supreme Court is reviewing it now. And now, of course, that will probably take about a year. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is the Kansas Court of Appeals found it to not be, you know, supporting workers. And so we will be tracking this litigation and the court's ruling to determine what steps we as the Kansas Department of Labor need to be taking, and also to ensure injured workers are properly being compensated between then. They continue that on working with our ombudsman. And so if any of you who are listening, if you have any questions and you want to speak with any of our ombudsmen that are here, we're here to serve and assist any injured workers with their workers' comp you know, issues or just the process in general, they can reach us here at 785-296-4000. That's what we're here for. And I will add as well, Governor Kelly, when she was campaigning, she also said that she supported the fourth edition as well, which more in line works with and supports the injured worker. And so we will be waiting to see what the Supreme Court rules on this one.
Well, that's good news. I hope they rule in favor of the workers, because it's terrible when you're hurt, your employer's responsible, and you get nothing. So we only have about a minute left. And I want to ask you I mentioned before that Kansas has a significant immigrant worker population. Can you talk about the contributions that immigrants make to the Kansas economy? And I'm asking you that specifically because when Chris Kobach was Secretary of State, we heard the constant drumbeat of insults against our immigrant workforce, saying that they were more of a cost than a benefit to the Kansas economy.
Yeah, absolutely not. Being a Mexican-American, born and raised here in Wichita, and both my parents were as well. My mom's from South Texas, but my dad's from Garden City, Kansas. And, you know, that was such an insult to hear that when I see, again, my hardworking grandparents. Yes, they were born in Mexico, but they were small business entrepreneurs who, you know, established the oldest restaurant in the state of Kansas, a family Mexican restaurant. So seeing from an early age from my own family story, I know that there's many of that. And as a state legislator, one thing that people remember me as is sort of the mother protector of the in-state tuition for those young students, again, paying into our colleges and universities in Kansas to attend school. We're having to pay international fees, which is triple the amount, and all we wanted, and I'm glad that Kansas still remains the third state in the country who put that into law in 2004. And so now we've grown these amazing young people who are still continuing to contribute to the Kansas economy. It is only right that we continue making sure that they stay here because as we see it with our economists right now, we are going to be aging out. The baby boomers are now retiring, and we need that workforce. And that workforce is among them our Latino immigrant workers.
Okay,
we'll be supporting, continuing to work with them as well.
Okay, well, we're out of time, unfortunately. Thank you so much. We've been talking to Delia Garcia, the Kansas Secretary of Labor. Thanks, Delia.
Thank you, Judy.
Turlock Boylan and Molly McLaughlin have been working together with Irish Flutes by a grant made possible by the Missouri Folk Arts Program. KKFI listeners can be treated to the fruits of their efforts on the local showcase, Thursday night at 8. On Memorial Day, Peaceworks KC will host its annual 10 a.m. rally at the old nuclear weapons plant on Bannister, east of Troost. Drive to Prospect and Highway 150 for an 11 a.m. march to the entry road to the new weapons plant, an 11:30 a.m. rally, and die-in. More info with Henry, 913-375-0045. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Honey, I work so hard for my money, and I leave my babies at home. Breaking my back trying to bring home a check and working my fingers to the bone. At the end of the day, it feels like a game, one I was born to lose. This institution, a dead revolution, is giving young women abuse. Pay gap, pay gap. Why don't you do the math?
Good evening and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Michael Savoir. The music tonight was by Margot Price, called Pay Gap. Our show is titled Kansas City Pay Gap Study, and our guests are Alice Kitchens with the Women's Equity Coalition and Scott Wagner, First District City Councilman and Mayor Pro Tem. Good evening to both of you.
Thank you
Good
very
evening.
Much.
Thank you for being on the Heartland Labor Forum. Let's start out by defining for our listeners what a pay gap study is. And perhaps, Alice, would you?
Yes. Pay gap is when you look at the difference between what men and women are paid in the same job doing the same work. So what we know from the data, and it varies year to year, that white women make 79% of what white men in the same job positions make. Black women make 63%. Hispanic women make 54%. And Native American women make 57% of what men make in the same position. So the gap is evident. It's been documented year after year. And if you think about the gap and living a lifetime and building retirement and all the other challenges that women have regarding child care and being in gender-dominated positions, which pay lower, the gap needs to be eliminated.
I couldn't agree with you more. Scott, anything to add to that?
No, I think what Alice has described is, you know, the basics of what we're trying to get to. You know, the issue that you have and what we hope to discover through some of the work that we're trying to do is, you know, when you kind of strip away some of the issues that come up in hiring, whether it is, you know, market conditions, you know, those things that happen as just part of business. When you strip all those away, what do you have, and what has been the habit of an entity, whether it's a for-profit business or a governmental entity like ours, and to really understand what and how we've done our hiring over time. And so, you know, all those statistics have been around for so long, and it's only really now that even nationally, I think that more people are starting to pay attention to these issues. And so Kansas City is trying to do its best to, what is it, make everything up to date in Kansas City, as the song goes. And so we're moving forward to do our analysis as well.
Mm-hmm. And I would just add that contrary to what the public thinks and knows, women are not in the Constitution. So when a case comes before the Constitution or the Supreme Court about pay inequities like the Walmart case or the UPS case or the domestic violence case, women don't prevail because we're not in the Constitution and we don't have that same standard that other people.
Well, we're still trying to figure out a way to have an equal rights amendment, and I hate to think about that. But, of course, gender bias has been a pretty well established factor in American life. I think the averages say 77 cents on a dollar. And of course, if we refine those figures you just mentioned, Alice, we'd probably come up with something close to that. Of course, a pay gap study then would seek to try to analyze the reasons for this. It wouldn't necessarily change it, though, Scott.
Well, take
a look at it first.
Well, you know, you've got to identify your issue before you can change an issue, right? And so, you know, within a governmental entity, and the city is no different than any other, you know, you have compensation levels that you generally have within each particular job classification that you have. Some are very well defined, like you have with a collective bargaining agreement. If you have a unit of workers that collectively bargain for what those levels are, and in other cases, you have general classifications and the dollar amounts that go with them in more of the salaried categories. But you know, again, it's trying to figure out whether to what degree, if any, the city, just as there have been other studies done in other cities, has somehow offered less to a female candidate than a male one. And, you know, again, it's kind of the idea with what we hope to do is, you know, once you strip away some of the market conditions that may drive an offer for one that may be different from another, what do you have and what has happened and what have we done as a city historically? And then you can figure out what's the problem, and then you can then address it and mm-hmm. fix it subsequently. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the starting point is gathering the data.
Right.
And so our expectation is that the vendor who does this work will have a database gathering information on the person in the job, their male counterpart, both of their education, degrees, years of experience in the same field, and noted and documented skills. And the employer may have a few other conditions, but those are objective measures, and they have nothing to do with the previous salary history. But so when you put all that data in the data gathering machine, then you'll have information that'll come out that'll show some information which other cities have gathered, and it gives them a starting point, a benchmark. Mm-hmm. And then you analyze it, you have findings, and then we hope that we'll have an oversight committee that will be individuals who know have had lots of employees themselves, or are lawyers who have had lawsuits that are based on pay inequities. Then we'll have some tools and we can go forward. And I would add racial disparity will be included, is my hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the two sort of go hand in hand. Tell me, Scott, what would the process be? Would you commission an independent agency or organization to take a look at this?
Yeah.
How would that work?
Yeah, so right now we're really on the final end of the procurement process for the service. So the service would be, that analysis rather, would be performed by a third party who can then look at all of our information, our hiring data, so that it's not our department, not our people per se looking at it, but rather getting that analysis done and done right. And, you know, to Alice's point, you know, the idea is that we have someone with experience at looking at this information who can provide us a good understanding of that hiring history, and looking at multiple classifications where you have a substantial enough hiring history and pool of workers to be able to see, you know, what has been the practice, and then to arrive at a conclusion as to whether or not there's an issue within that classification or not. But so we kind of just for everybody to kind of know the background. So last summer we put a request for proposal out for a consultant who would help the city go through that process. A few months later, the city selected someone to do that work. We are now kind of at the end point of negotiating with that contractor, and so there should be an ordinance that comes forward that suggests who's going to do the work, and to reiterate what the scope of that work is, and what the expectation should be for us, whether it's the city or for anyone else who is interested, to know when that work should be complete. Mm-hmm. So the work hasn't begun, but I'm probably speaking for Alice when I say we had hoped it would have started yesterday, but we're getting close to finally beginning and commencing with the work and mm-hmm. the analysis.
Now, Alice, your group, Women's Coalition for Pay Equity, did I say that right?
Yeah, Women's Equality Coalition. We consist of 11 women's organizations, and we are interested in pay equity, and some of the organizations in particular, this is their forte as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this. Once such a study is complete, would it offer possible remedies, or would then from the recommendations from such a study, would your group kind of move in
my thinking is that the data speaks for itself, but the people who are doing research usually come up with findings. And findings are disparities, information or insights or suggestions. But that's one set of information. We want the oversight committee to really make the recommendations to the city and have indicators and measures and then timetables and, you know, actual people who are carrying out the work and accountable, mm-hmm. and have that all in a master grid. That's all in my mind, mm-hmm. and it's my expectation that that's how you achieve change. One area we didn't talk about, but it will show up, it's inevitable, and that is gender-dominated professions. Mm-hmm. So drivers of the water department trucks, probably more men than women, but sure. I know they're women because we've read the stories in the magazines mm-hmm. about them. So it's always an indication to move more of the opposite or under-dominated gender into those professions if they meet the same basic requirements at the get-go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read the study compiled by the City of Seattle in 2013 or 14, mm-hmm. and my God, it was such a
yes.
complicated, there's so many factors involved here, mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. no simple fix. Yet I see the potential and just starting the process, then we're along the road to making it happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's commendable, Scott.
Well, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that. And, you know, I want to reiterate, you know, what Alice just said as far as, you know, when you do these and just by way of comparison, you might remember a couple years ago we did an MBE-WBE study to update our program there. And, you know, you just in the same way here, you expect to get the analysis. You may get some suggestions based on what that analysis says, but ultimately you hope that what comes from that is a policy position that then the city needs to move forward on. And that's where, you know, those suggestions we expect to come. So the study in and of itself is not really the end result. Mm-hmm. It is merely the tool by which you get to what is it that we may need to change within the city in order to get a better balance that we're looking for.
Mm-hmm. And as we representatives of the Women's Equality Coalition met with the city council members and we talked to each one of them, there was a recognition that there may be legal problems that come out of it, or there may be consequences of cost changes. But nobody seemed to think that's unusual or seemed to see that as an obstacle for not doing this. Mm-hmm. And I think in the private sector, they do it all the time. Sure. They're looking at classification. Are we as an employer at the bottom of the barrel of our workers in this job category? And do we want to be at the bottom? Is mm-hmm. that the kind of employer mm-hmm. we want right. to be? So I think that the city of Kansas City can be a great leader. And I think we may be better than some entities in the private sector because of a commitment to the public service and public good.
Oh, yeah. When that exists, why resolution is easy to, I won't say easy, but it makes it more possible, certainly. Mm-hmm. And when both sides are have a strong desire for the same ultimate.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And if you don't mind me adding, Michael, one of the things that we may find, and Alice's comment made me think of it, you know, you may find that there has not been an issue in some of these categories as far as anything that the city has done wrong, but what it may point out is that in some classifications, the pool of applicants is weighted in a certain direction, yeah. which then suggests, okay, we need to do a better job or work with other partners to help expand the pool of women. You know, just taking the drivers, for example, you know, and now I'm just making up stuff, so let me just say that before I say this. You know, we may find that, okay, we are not getting a number of women coming forward for drivers. That may mean we need to work with the private sector to get more CDLs in the commercial driver's licenses in the hands mm-hmm. of potential female candidates so mm-hmm. that we can, you know, grow that pool. Of course, you know, don't know that until we go through the process we're talking about. But that could, something like that could be what comes from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly we can probably all agree that a detailed study and analysis provides information that improves working conditions throughout mm-hmm. the city's administration. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so certainly just based on that alone, I think it would be welcome, not just by women's groups, but by all groups mm-hmm. that would could possibly be impacted. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, gender gap issues and racial inequities are kind of hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so certainly such a study would improve both sides of
sure.
that coin.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you might want to ask Scott to explain what he's going to do next week.
Yeah, Scott, you've got an interesting proposal. Recommendation, is it?
Yeah, yes.
Coming up next week. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, I appreciate that. So we have coming up in discussion in committee next week in the Transportation Committee next Thursday morning, a proposal to remove the salary history question across all employers in Kansas City. We made that change within Kansas City government last September, and which I think has done very well for us. But the idea is that, especially for those, and again, it primarily falls on women generally, where they have had to step out of the labor force for family reasons, other reasons, but it's not just for women only. But you find that when you come back into the labor force, in a sense, you are punished for being out. Because if someone asks you for your salary history and you give it, and you have been out of the workforce, the likelihood is that you will essentially depress your own wage for the next job that you take. And the long-term issue, of course, is for those who are trying to get retirement and they're trying to figure that out. If your base is low, your retirement's low. Mm-hmm. And I think anybody in the workforce understands that. So,
well, yeah, that makes certainly makes sense to me. I'm excited, Scott, about this gender gap study, and I think it kind of distinguishes our town as one of the progressive towns across the country. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank both of you for being on the Heartland Labor Forum tonight to explain that to our listeners, and we'll follow up to share any further developments along this line.
All right.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today I thought maybe I'd talk a little bit about the Equal Pay Act of 1963. This is a federal law that prohibits pay discrimination on the basis of sex. It amends the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. The EPA requires that employers pay similarly situated employees in the same establishment the same wage regardless of the sex. If they perform the job that required substantially equal skills, efforts, and responsibility under similar working conditions. This law covers any type of payment made to employees like salary, overtime, bonuses, stock options, life insurance, vacation, holiday, pay allowance, reimbursement, expenses, and benefits. The law requires that similarly situated employees be paid the same. Now, don't get the Equal Pay Act confused with Title VII. Title VII is in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It's much broader than the EPA. While the EPA only prohibits discrimination based on sex, Title VII bars many other forms of employment discrimination, including discrimination related to hiring, firing, and promotions, as well as pay. Title VII also protects classes in addition to sex, including race, color, religion, and national origin. It also includes sex. So if you think you are being discriminated on the basis of your sex, you might have a claim under either or both acts. So under the EPA, in order to bring a claim, an employee must show that a female employee and a male employee are receiving different wages, for performing substantially similar work. This also has to be in the same establishment, so in the same business, and under similar working conditions. Something interesting about the EPA is that the phrase substantially equal work doesn't require that the two people have identical titles. Instead, they look at the actual substance of the job. Now, one good thing about this act is that it imposes something in the law called strict liability on the employer. So that means a person bringing a claim has to show that the wage difference is there. That's it. They don't have to show an intent to discriminate. So in this case, what you have to show is that the jobs are substantially similar, not that the employer intended to behave in a discriminatory fashion. On the employer side, a defense to the Equal Pay Act, the employer must prove that wages are set pursuant to one of four statutory defenses that are allowed under the EPA. One is a seniority system, meaning that people who have been there longer get higher pay. They could also show that they have a merit system in place, or a system that measures earnings by the quantity or quality of production, or on a factor other than sex. So those are the defenses under the Equal Pay Act. Remember that the employer doesn't, or the employee who feels like there may have been discrimination doesn't have to show evil intent or that there was an intention to discriminate on the basis of sex, just that it is happening. And the two people in question have substantially similar jobs. If you are an employee that feels like you have been unfairly paid on the basis of your sex, you can make a claim under either the Equal Pay Act or Title VII, or sometimes both. There are many reasons that you might choose both. If you feel like you have been discriminated, I might suggest that you contact an employment lawyer, because the process for these are different, and some of them are time barred as well. One big difference between the Equal Pay Act and Title VII is that for an Equal Pay Act claim, you don't first need to file a claim in the administrative agency of the EEOC. I mentioned time bars. Time limit for filing an EPA charge is within 2 years of the alleged unlawful compensation practice, or in the case of a willful violation, within 3 years. If you think you've been discriminated against, make sure that you keep records and document your experience, and talk to a lawyer as soon as possible to protect your rights. Kansas City, that's all the time we have for tonight. Again, this is Angie Williams from the law offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Thanks, and be safe.
Okay, and now this is Heart and Labor Forum calendar. All right, on Saturday, May 18th, that is this Saturday, it is the third Saturday Wyandotte County Democratic Breakfast. 8:15 is the breakfast and 9 a.m. is the speaker, and it will be at La Islas Maria's at 7516 State Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas. And the speaker, it will be Representative Cherise Davids. Monday, May 20th from 5 to 8 p.m., it's a monthly clinic for victims of wage theft, and that will be at El Centro at 650 Minnesota Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. Monday, May 20th from 7 to 8:30 p.m., it is the SURJKC monthly meeting, and then we'll discuss why fight racism, what's at stake for white people. And that is at St. Mark's Hope and Peace at 3800 Troost in KCMO. And lastly, Jobs of Justice monthly OC meeting will be at All Souls UU Church at 4501 Walnut in KCMO on Tuesday, May 21st at 6:30 p.m. You can check out the rest of the Heartland Labor Forum calendar live on the web at heartlandlaborforum.org. Thanks so much for tuning in to tonight's show. Next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, our show will be United Fruit Company, Rotten Bananas, and Keeping America White, U.S. Immigration Policy. I've been your host and engineer, Jen Zaman, and Judy will be back with us next week. Have a good night.
Disgrace and standing side by side with working people, sweating for an earnest wage I'll never be ashamed of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
struggle.